This is a reading from a book that I have just published called The Book of Hearts. And it's been really fun for me, a real privilege to be in Holden Village this summer, having had this book follow me along. Because I've been able to give readings and I've been able to be in the presence of my daughters, and a lot of my reading and writing has to do with keeping track, leaving a trace, remembering the experiences of my life, whether it was when I was very young on a ranch in South Dakota, or as an angry feminist mom lost in suburbia with three kids, or in later years where a lot of my sensibilities have changed and I want to keep remembering, because where I was at one point, which was very important to me, and I want to remember what that feels like, but then I change and I find myself at a different place. And I think some of those things are still important in the lives of other people, even though I think of especially my angry feminist poetry that I discovered while feeling so lonely, raising kids in Minnesota in long winters, and the exile that I felt. I grew up on a farm in South Dakota. I was the oldest of three children, a daughter. We were daughter, daughter, son. And we didn't know that people were waiting for a son to leave land to, or that one had to have the right gender in order to come into being considered as someone who would be thought of in relationship of the land. I was a tomboy. I loved my dad. I was with him all the time. I was seldom in the house. And I can remember sitting on our large barn on this ranch, looking out over it when I was about 8 years old, knowing someday it would be mine. Aha. 6 years, you know, I have a brother who's 6 years younger than I, and really the legacy of all that my mother and father worked very hard for has really gone to him, and the daughters were expected to probably leave home, get an education, marry, and go do something else. Which we did, but not without a lot of pain, a pain that I haven't forgotten. And I've lived more years in Minnesota now than I lived in South Dakota, but I do not ever get the prairie out of my blood. I have to go home. Sometimes it's so compelling that I do it spontaneously. I think on a particular afternoon that I have to go home, and I pack a bag and I get in the car and go. And it's a kind of long drive, but I have to do that. So I think I'll start tonight. I belong to a writing group in Northfield, Minnesota, and it's called Northfield Women Poets. We are 10, 11 in number. We've been meeting for about 20 years, and we meet every week. And we bring our work, and we critique it, and we encourage each other to write, and some are more aggressive about that than others. Some just want to write. They don't care if they're ever discovered or published or anything. Another woman and I started this in those quiet and lonely years when I was at home. I guess I can't emphasize enough the betrayal that I felt by a culture and by a family who said if I had a college education, I could do anything I ever wanted to be. And there is some truth in that, but you have to see through a lot of stuff in order to realize that, because if you get married after college and spend 10 years raising kids and then decide you want a job, your vita isn't very long, your resume. What you have to put on that is not substantial in the eyes of the world. Even St. Olaf College, from which I graduated, would not hire me until I took a typing test. And I had taken typing in my junior year of high school, and that's what got me my job after raising kids. And I have felt a great deal of disenfranchisement about that. David and I have had a really terrific life together in lots of ways. He's sitting right over there in the pink shirt. And there are lots of things we wouldn't change. But one thing we probably would change is that when we were both 23 and newly married, we would put four shoulders to the wheel for two of us to discover what it was we wanted to do and be, rather than four shoulders to the wheel for him and graduate school and 8 long years of moving and ending up wherever it was he was going to be. And there's an intentionality about that that I was clueless about. There were a few people who saw through it and and did things in a different way than I did. But not a lot of us. The people who are my age, we share this experience. And then we find out later, maybe after divorce, maybe after illness and death, maybe after other kinds of things, that you are on your own and accountable, and then it's very hard work. So I'm going to read a couple of pieces just about family, about leaving trace. I have a daughter who's 30 who is also a writer and has just studied with a woman named Carolyn Forché, who became famous writing 8 poems about her experience in El Salvador. Put them in the front of a book in, I think it was about 1970, I'm not sure of the date, but anyway, she won an award for that book and has been a political activist writer ever since. And she has just compiled an anthology called Against Forgetting. And this book pulls poems from all over the world of people writing in extremity, whether it's in a situation of war, or whether it's in imprisonment, or situations of isolation and loneliness. It was a very difficult book to pull together. And they talk about writing, poetry, journals, whatever, as leaving trace. Sometimes you find the trace of a person in their life only through scraps of paper that you find in a shirt of someone killed in a war, that kind of thing. And then you know what experience that was. Mine is not in that dramatic a vein, but as Rebecca has been reading and talking and studying about this person, I think of it in also a daily way. It's a way to leave tracks. And so I'm going to read a little bit about some family. Well, maybe I'll start with a couple of fun ones first. I was keeping track of things even when the kids were small and in my hair, and I didn't know what to do with them or me. And one of the poems that I sometimes read in high schools that kids like a lot is one called Rollerway. And I took Jonathan and 13 friends to the roller rink for his birthday one day. They were all in this large car. They were 11, just turned 11. And I had to have them be quiet because I couldn't drive to Apple Valley without a little quiet in the car. And so at one point I had to pull to the side of the road and say, okay, this car isn't going anywhere until it's nice and quiet in here. And we got to the roller rink. But what happened there was fascinating to me. There was one little girl who knew how to skate. And I ended up writing about it. And 11 and 12 and 13-year-old kids love this poem called Rollerway. Preteen woman, she skates a real cool number. No group rate skate for her, she owns her own, red pom-poms and all. With a plum round and round the rink, she moves, hair streaming, 12 boys on the brink of knowing skate after her. Jostle one another for an advantage point. The coolest of the 12 jockeys her to the side toward coke and compromise, while the others yell some 11-year-old obscenities. She knows her slim advantage, this Lorelei. She takes brief tandem alliance with a girlfriend, strength in pairs, roller smooth duet. T-shirted, the 12 lean their gray elbows on pinball machines. Look over their shoulders to see if she looks over her shoulder to see she was not caught looking, solo performance, singing roller smooth. That was really fun. And another fun one, the year that Jonathan graduated from high school, the commencement was down on the St. Olaf campus green, and a streaker went by. It was a high school friend of his. And the funny thing that happened, this guy just sort of loped on this day. Everybody sort of speechless as he went from one end to the other. And then he raced up the hill into some trees behind a dormitory, and suddenly the cops, the on-foot cops, got into motion and went up after him. And they all came kind of falling out down the hill. And I ended up writing about it. And, of course, there were lots of upset people, but there was something so wonderful about it. Small town commencement. How to describe the gorgeous day, air pure enough to disrobe in, green and blue coming together in perfect ceremony. The graduates wore white. Soap bubbles rose and burst their lofty bellies far downfield on a lazy wind. Then he came, loping slowly onto the field from the right. The speaker and the students understood, and grandmother smiled. His body bright in the late afternoon sun, its shadow an eloquent mimic, as his strong member did a rhythmic solo dance backed up by the orchestra of his young body. All the mortarboards tipped his way, small salutes. Then a policeman, dark in his purpose, dark uniform, stark against skin, against the white robes, gave chase, and he slipped and fell before our eyes in the way we dream about when we remember the way we were in our own youth and in our dreams. And then sometimes there are things that are just shake you for whatever reason. And I don't know if you remember, quite a few years ago now, an airplane crash in Texas where a man in a Toyota, the poem sort of says it. I mean, this plane was coming in for a landing and it didn't make it. And there was one car on the highway in front of the place where it was coming down, and the guy was killed. And you can't help but ask these questions, why that person, why that place? And it's so true of so many, many things, but I happen to pick this. It's called The Man in the Toyota. A Delta flight in Dallas dropped one evening out of dark black clouds and almost made the runway. A man left work in Dallas, new job, new town, to call his wife in Mississippi, took a new way home. The storm brought both the man and plane together into a dimension out of time and space. The plane tipped one wing, acknowledged it, and spun to fire, lost. 28 years before in Mississippi, that man was born. He shot pool, played marbles, went to school, slopped the hogs, mowed hay, and met a girl. Had sons, lost a job, moved to Texas, worked 2 days, and took the wrong way home. The details of that were in the paper. It still gives me goosebumps. My mother is 80 some years old and had aneurysm surgery last January, and it was pretty traumatic. I mean, my mother's elderly, and she knows better than we do that she doesn't have very long left. She's fragile in health. But she had this big surgery, which is a large surgery for someone who's a lot younger than she is. And she came through it all right. But one of the things that really affected her was the anesthetic that they used. And she had hallucinations for about 3 days afterwards. And she was terrified. She was angry. Even remembering it, she's angry. She's such a practical person that she doesn't even like to dream. So someone like this having hallucinations was having a hard time. And we couldn't really explain to her. My sister and brother and I, we were all there, and we keep telling her things, and the hallucinatory phenomenon kept taking place, and she would be, by the time we would come to see her the next morning, she'd be scared to death and in that place again. So this is called aneurysm. After the deep surgery, they put her out onto the street, she thought. Then the nurses brought in men, caroused, and refused to care for her. Men patients casually went by as she attempted to rise from a commode, having been left there cold, awaiting a nurse who'd promised to bring a robe that never came. She hauled herself back to the bed, furious, patronized, scolded even for putting herself back to bed. The morphine hung on for days. She made her favorite daughter cry by accusing her of being in cahoots, both Connie and the hospital trying to kill her. She, my sister, and I sang a trio, old rhymes, Christmas carols, tunes from the 30s, till she interrupted us with, "What ceremony is this?" She thought it last rites. And we found her one morning in restraints, black and blue arms, puffy ballooning fists. She had kicked someone, then tried to rip out the tubes with her stubby fingers, fat beyond any reasonable memory we had of our mother's most unusual hands. She really did kick someone, and of course then forgot it. And then after she was home for a week, it sort of came up. My sister told her about having done that, and my mother said, "Well, why didn't Karen tell me that I'd kicked somebody?" She thought it was wonderful that she had fought back like that, and the fact that we hadn't told her. I really did. I really fought back. And you sure did. But a poem like this, it is one of those things. I'm not really a journal keeper, although I've been keeping a journal here this summer. But when I look at this, I will remember those days. You know, it's just the details of a few days of very intense concern and care about someone, and it puts you right back in that place. And some of it can be fun, and some of it can be heartbreaking, and at the end of it, it all feels important. We have these three children. The older one that I mentioned, Jonathan, who is 27, is a professional juggler and has juggled before Johnny Carson threw in the towel. Jonathan and his juggling partner had been on that program twice. And then we have Allison, who's cooking and singing here for you. So I end up writing about things they do, whether it's leaving home or... One of the things Jonathan did in his youth, which bothered me a lot, was to own a motorcycle. And it was one of those things you knew you couldn't say no to, but it caused a lot of anxiety. And one year he was planning to juggle at a Renaissance fair in Colorado, and he and his friend were leaving on their motorcycles. And I wanted him to get an early start in the morning. And of course they didn't want anyone telling them when they should leave home. And they packed all day long. And by nighttime, it was almost beginning to get dark, although it was summer, finally he was ready to go, and there was a storm coming in. He just said, "Don't worry," and took off. And here's my song, my poem about that. It's called Please, and please can be P-L-E-A-S, or with an E on the end. Your motorcycle hums a spinning song. You whistle and ready yourself. Pack maps, addresses, sundries, an anniversary card my size, all tied to the cycle with bungee cords. Then you head out into night and dark clouds spitting lightning. Later your call comes from North Platte. The storm eluded you, tore north and east while you spun south. Now you own your own decisions and are not haunted by the uneasy wind and a mother's pleas. Be careful. Eat well. Do not juggle the torches when they are too hot, or the sickles. Why not the multi-hued scarves instead? Another goodbye poem. As this poet daughter moved away to Washington, D.C. for the first time, the woman she studied with, Carolyn Forché, I have also studied with, and at one point in northern Minnesota, Carolyn had her three-year-old with her. And this three-year-old was very active, and Carolyn was trying to teach a class, and she had another young person taking care of her little boy, Sean. And she was trying to get Sean out of the room, and Sean, in a very loud voice, said, "I will never leave you, Mommy. I am your best friend." And I've sort of remembered that, and as my daughter went to study with Carolyn Forché, that's what I wanted to say to Carolyn. You know, my daughter doesn't want to leave me. She's my best friend. Goodbye. I cannot say the word out loud all day today, you in the driveway, me driving away, though it is you who are leaving. I cannot speak this sorrow, how I will miss you, because I cannot add to your ache. Instead, I give your fiancé a coat of my father's, slip my sorrow into its light gray sleeves, fully clothed, not naked, like the part riding north with me. Strange how I knew for months you were going, yet it came too quickly for words. I sit here tonight writing in the chill air 300 miles north of the cities. The birches shiver all the while you drive to Virginia. Did I never tell you in my world east is an unnatural direction? A couple of my feminist ones. There's been a movie made about this phenomenon. Remember the woman who got raped by several people on a pool table? Ended up writing about that. We have a group of friends called our potluck friends that we graduated from college with, and the night after this was in the papers, we were all having dinner together, and I was trying to explain to this group of good friends why this appalled me so much, and I couldn't get it across. I ended up leaving our dinner table early because it was so hurting to me that I couldn't communicate the awfulness of this event to these friends, especially to the men friends in the group. Somehow she must have asked for it. What did she wear? Did she raise an eyebrow, slink up to the bar, twitch her ass, lift her eyes from the floor, horror of horrors, and meet a man's eyes? 2.5 hours splayed on a pool table, 4 men taking turns. Of course the crowd of men cheered. A score was made, just one more ball in the pocket, the deadly game into overtime, and the scent of cum in the air. Tonight at dinner, we discussed the event. No empathy, No empathy from the men at my table, my guests, these, the men who love us, parent our daughters, our sons. We are in an incredible danger. I say murder is better. At least the spirit goes free. They disagree, these men at my table, eating my roast, slurping their chocolate desserts, a hint of amaretto on their tongues. How could murder be better than rape? Their penises push at their trousers under my table, lay hard and impatient on their thighs. Until they truly inhabit our skins and share this danger, no woman, no daughter, no mother is safe. I think we'll go to farm country now for a little bit. Take you through a few phases of my life. The ranch I grew up in is in northeast South Dakota, not so far from the North Dakota border. And it's on a game refuge. And the game refuge it's a wonder. I mean, it's wonderful to run through. It's wonderful to drive a pickup through and see the deer run. They aren't quite as close as in the village, but there are a lot more of them. And I have ended up being very connected to this piece of land. Makes me understand a little bit, only a little, what the Native Americans felt like when all of these Europeans arrived to take it away from them. The shore of a sandy lake abuts the edge of my memory, close like the much-loved land. Some of us, mostly daughters, move away. But the feel of earth between our toes, sun hot above grain spun to gold, chaff and itch beneath our shirts, sweat, and the brief cool reprieve of a reluctant rain washing through the cracks of western window frames on the old home place remain vivid. As if being young there had just happened. And our mother, seated in the shade of an elm shelling peas, lifts her head at our father's call from his pickup truck window to come check cattle at the Dacre place. The shore of a sandy lake weaves along the reed-slim edge of my memory like the haunting land. Each autumn I hear calves bawling, and the calling geese, blues, and snows fall from grace in that season. Years gather like fleet clouds on the horizon. I love original earth, like the pasture at home in Dakota that's never been plowed. Its curves reveal the circular shadows of Indian encampments, and pasque flowers, faint feathery blue, the saffron stamens reaching like feelers. I remember my Mustang's hooves crushing them, yet the pasques return spring after spring. They push up baked clay while tied yet to the earth's apron. Each year since then, the land's curves harbor pheasant nest secrets, the broken shells of my memory of mowing the blowing grasses. How in the last round I would leap off the tractor to run through the narrow swath of still-standing brome. I would chase out the small furred and feathered before finally thrusting that sickle through. Dad wondered what always took me so long on the last round, and I never told him. I wish I had, but I had not yet learned what we had in common, the prairie in our veins like blood. Maybe if we'd each sliced a wrist and held them tightly to each other, both of us would have been more grounded. Maybe everything else would have been different. And in this poem, I describe the house I grew up in. My grandfather built it in 1908, and I don't know of any houses within 60 miles that are like this. It's a three-story large house with oak trim, and the trim is carved in the tops of the lintels in the house, and the dowels that make the stairs that go up are all carved. It took us a long time before we realized what house this was. And it had high ceilings, and I always feel odd in houses with low ceilings, and I know it's from growing up in this house. So this is a description of this place, and I just wrote this an Easter ago when I was home for Easter, called The Heart of the Matter. This house, raised against all odds on the east side of Sand Lake in South Dakota in 1908, rebuilt itself in my heart. In the years after I was 20, I moved fast, moved 8 different places in fewer years, unaware that builders had been contracted and were already at work on a monumental task in my heart's space. Oak banisters and all. 17 individually carved dolls to the landing, 27 more to the second floor, the bottom pillar with a loose lid where kids dropped a German oak nutcracker one holiday, and we didn't tell. He lay there for years. Later, I searched for him with a flashlight, but he'd gone, and I do not know his rescuer. No other truly grand houses line Sand Lake, the kind with carved lintels above each downstairs window and sliding oak doors between the two largest rooms. But even such a house could not save Grandma Herseth from herself, her own dark interior, as Grandpa's large laugh resounded through its rooms after he had bet on horses or drunk himself into stupors in distant towns. This house's attic, in my heart, allows such a view of distance that to this day hills or too many tall trees closet me. Each spring, the pull on my body home foreshadows the day my heart falls down, the great-grandfather clock finally quiet in the heart's room. A refinished bookcase held cattle medicine in my young dad helping days. The dining room still contains the carved table, the buffet, and eight chairs that my mother bought for $74.88 when she was young, before her marriage even. My luck to be brought to this house in 1940, a newborn. I know its intimacies, every depth of corner. I can move in its dark without sound, my hand finding light switches or landing places before my head does. The women who come to this house to live with the men who own it do not know their way here as my sister and I do. And we banished ones resent those who later offer civilly to please feel at home. All the rest of the years that they live in this house, they will never carry its great weight in such a small place as a heart. And on that prairie, I herded cattle, and I thought I was safe from everything. We were a long ways from anything dangerous, I thought. And I herded cattle for hours for my dad, usually bareback. I'd come home at the end of the day and just having been both in a reverie of my mind and in a reverie of place. And it wasn't until much later that I learned about how dangerous the Dakotas are with their hidden silos. You may have the silos outside of barns that look copacetic and people like to paint, but the other kind were there too. And this was a poem about that. I was 11, bored and herding Dad's cattle. I was off the horse and knew I was in the safest spot in all the land, surrounded by acres of grass. My horse and I, the tallest shadows anywhere, soon noticed some short grass tips mounded up nearby, a tiny hut, it seemed, with a hole inside, and I sat down to muss it up a bit, stuck my horse's bridle rein deep inside, and three bare-teethed mice came bristling out. They glared at me, then jumped again, and I jumped back. Those little dagger teeth shone very white, and I a real danger felt. Just 11, I didn't know about the buried silos in the prairie underbelly and about the reincarnation of their guards. I was teasing mice in a little tuft of grass, and they took after me, and I got really scared. And this is a fairly recent poem that alludes to the death of my father. My dad died on January 24th in 69. He was only 59 years old, and he'd had a heart condition for 10 years, which meant he got his heart condition when he was 49. And when I passed age 49, I really thought about how young that was and how I had missed him, even though we fought hard in my young adolescent years. So always around January 24th, I feel very sober about a lot of things. I don't know my dad very well, certainly not as a young adult. And he didn't get to know our kids and love children, and I always miss that. This is called Horse. From 24 December to January 24, each day hangs opaquely toward the earth. A horse from the past steps out of a foggy landscape as I drive to the cities calling on the memory of horse. Bessie, Grey Lady, Dandaree, the black one I never named. I remember the spirited sound, the hooves, the ice trip on this road to the airport at my father's dying, the dark, snaking, hearse-led line of cars through snow. The creature horse in my head. Our source connected skin, a deep memory, language resonating from the withers. That black horse, carrier of more than spirit but nothing left, lived briefly on the land of my youth. My brother found it dead. Horsepower, round of belly, great in shoulder, aging, I have come to look like horse. It has little to do with a fast way out. Already I have lived long at the edge, neither in nor out of town. My piece of grass too small for horse or self. Once many horses, Angus too, ran in my father's fields. I thought my inheritance contained them. Then I married, traveled, birthed babies, learned I left more than horse behind. A pinto appears on the skyline. Its black-white arrangement of skin moves close to the freeway. I leave the car. It will not come to me, will not put its nostrils and remembered breath into my palm. But someday my lost, unnamed horse will reappear, will prophesy. I search till then the winter prairie, the roadways, and all the far pastures. One of the things that I think is a shame is that I lived in Dakota for a long time before I really understood much about the plight of the Native Americans. And I've written a couple of pieces that allude to that. For instance, in one of these poems, you'll hear about prayer flags. I learned about prayer flags in Nepal and in Japan before I learned about them as Native American ceremonial objects. And I think that's appalling. To live 50 miles from this kind of situation and not know that. The dam in the middle of South Dakota is called a wahi, and that means in Sioux, something firm to stand upon. And this dam backs water up all the way from the middle of South Dakota to the middle of North Dakota. And our family lives near that, and it's a mixed blessing indeed. This is called a wahi. A wahi in Sioux, something firm to stand upon, earthen dams, human or those in the mind, so much held back. How many years did it take to have it feel good to be home? No apologies. I drown in the warmth. It seeps under my skin, sustains not quite till next time. A wahi dam, something firm to stand upon. Yet it holds back acres and acres. Water that weighs down the bones of sea creatures, buffalo, wolves, pioneers. A bleached mosaic tale from before the days of salt. But what dam living can hold back sorrow, acres and acres of tears, or stem the flood of error? A wahi in Sioux, something firm to stand upon. Swirls, the title of this is Given Three Shells. Somebody gave me a shell and I was to write about it, and it was one of these where the seashells sort of swirled up to the top. Swirls, small creases, a crevasse, a small brown trail arcing around the gone snail. Like the trail we crawled slowly in the heat last summer up and around Bear Butte in the Black Hills, where prayer flags waved, tipped with grain, placed carefully into the crooked arms of old giant trees. And I remarked that it was wrong I should be this old and know about prayer flags in Nepal and in Japan, and not know of the Native American ones fluttering in sacred trees just 50 miles from my home. And then we'll move into, I find I like to write sometimes about the topics other people don't think should just be out there for everybody to read. So I've been writing about being 50 and menopause, as well as I write about some other things. So this is one of the up menopausal poems, and I'll read you a few. And I'll probably read you a few that are not so up. This is called Hand Me Down. I am 50 for 3 days now, and today comes a letter in my mother's hand. She is remembering, and tells me of that remembering. How on the day that I was born, I was stubborn and did not want to leave her, the warm pouch. How I did not yet care about the outside wonders. She tells me how, inexperienced and uninformed, she learned to push alone. And at 10 p.m. on a Saturday in 1940, she gathered her whole blood from the source and pushed me out into the light. So that today, a half century later, I can read aloud a poem from a daughter in Washington, D.C., and last night could hear a song coming down the centuries on my other daughter's tongue, a seer echoing her sister, Mama, I am coming home. Leaving taught me how absurd it is to think that we can ever leave. An Oriental fan of cherry blossoms arrives from my son in Japan. I think of him there, how he writes in the fan that he wants to hear my voice. I know what he means, because just last Sunday I walked to church nearly singing aloud because my mother and I had talked an hour on the phone of family things close to the bone, to hers, to mine, and flesh of her flesh I was warm and walking, almost singing, my heart throbbing its regular beat with the odd click I'd been told that sometimes mothers hand down to daughters. I think to myself I should remember to tell them. Tell them it's perfectly natural. Tell them not to be alarmed when they are told of the click, the heart's wonder that I too hand down. It was not good luck last night to find a real chewed-on rabbit's foot on the bedroom floor, but an omen of this time in life for me. I picture the rabbit out there somewhere huddled beneath a bush, screaming silently as rabbits can. Or maybe it's just hunks of fur cast far abreast a carcass, camouflaged babies somewhere hiding in the grass. My birthright set of years has half wound down, the children's choices ones I would not choose. A spirit in the wind bodes ill this spring, for near Alaskan shores, birds plunge in oil leaking from an Exxon tanker. Feathers clog and part, the cold creeps in. Even Arctic birds cannot survive the poison licking at the flanks of land. My blood slows down, my arms and legs begin to feel it first, the age-old glacial truth that cannot take the heat of years, but drips an unseen melt of blood in deep climactic change. Outside, the dog still waits for me to toss the foot to her. These are the months of dark blood and waiting, for the body will move to a new state, uprooted. It will not be like moving home, although the distance isn't far, but rather like marrying into a close-knit private family where all the bones are alien to your own, yet the passage is one. Bones become dust, yet skin drapes them. Friends notice, but the real crumbles inside like a mind leaving a crime scene. You can see these are really happy ones, aren't they? This body changed before my eyes, and I was helpless to stop it. Young, I had thought I was in charge, could will myself tall, slim, almost happy. But the body had other ideas. Lowered its center of gravity from the head to the belly, preparing for I don't know what. Although the bones talk among themselves, mostly at night, and I dream in their language, come morning I cannot recall dialect, inflection, or especially meaning. Too soon, September. A strong wind rattles these pages in my hands like someday my bones will as my breath leaves. 200 miles south, my husband works on a wedding. 2,000 miles to the east, our daughter prepares. I try to mark it about the diligent man, her father, about the young woman who thinks a lot like me, except passionately. Where did such passion come from? Or rather, where did mine go? Turning 50 took so much out of me. In one flash, bones whitened and weakened like so much parchment. My legs had become stiff as birches. Suddenly surrounded by seagulls, I thrust my neck up, back, up again, and I'm walking and screaming. In angry preening, I walk and scream. My knees, like the gulls, have grown knobby and covered with years. My husband stretches his hand north over the fir trees toward me. He means to pluck me back into this body he loves, yet I know I am leaving. I wait for a wedding that will spirit her away, yet I am the one who is going. My hope is the ceremony will distract everyone. Maybe even no one will notice. Oh, and then I had a very weird experience in Northfield. At a cafe. Death can come as you sit in a cafe quietly talking. It can lie on its side blending in and slip down your throat with the ease of a pin baked into French bread. When it falls from the upstanding collar of a busy shopkeeper up at 5 a.m. rolling dough out on her sideboard, as she hurriedly fastened a blouse with it, where a button dropped off. It refused the task and falls to the doe toward a destiny beyond itself till it is lifted up in clenched amazement between the forefinger and the thumb of a chewing, visiting woman who had struck something firm between her molars, hesitated, almost swallowed, kept talking and chewing the bread with her friend in the cafe. She places the pin on a serving tray like a scalpel and gravely shows the proprietress. It lies there innocent, awaiting the next hand that will put it to use. I found a pin in bread, one of the straight pins, and I almost swallowed it. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know how you aren't really thinking about your eating at a point like that? And I was aware that I had hit something, but it wasn't that hard, and I didn't want to be interrupted from the visiting. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Okay. One of the things that I would like to shift to now, I talked my daughter Allison into coming to end our time together. One of the great blessings of our family was something that we came to learn over only a few years ago, and that's that our youngest daughter is lesbian. And given things that we know now, we look back and go, duh, you know? Why couldn't we understand or see some of these things earlier? But we had a lot to learn. And I'm not happy about the baggage that I have had to throw off my back from the church and from the culture about how to love this daughter as I intend to do and as I know that our God intends us to do. And so one of the reasons that I wanted to put out a book like this is that the first 10 poems in it have to do with parenting and coming to understand an issue that we didn't understand very well in the beginning. And it has been a great blessing to our family, including these 80-some-year-old grandparents that you've been hearing me read about. And I wrote a poem for Allison here at Holden Village when she was 10 years old that I named Before Language. And in college, she wrote an answer back, sang it with her guitar. And so she's going to end this poetry reading with that song, but I'll read a few of the other poems that I've written about this before that. And we'll end a little bit early tonight because I think an hour of poetry is far and above beyond the call of duty for you folks. This Before Language poem I'll read first and then I'll come back to it to repeat because her song is so much an answer to it. Daughter, sometimes I know your eyes follow me, and I would like to talk to you in the language of women easy in each other's company. So often when I try, the words are wrong, my humor like a tune off key not well received in your ear or your heart. But I promise I will wait for a day when we reach the same language, the sounds deep in our memories of another time when in the womb strumming the same chord, we needed no words. This poem resulted, I call it Ermine, resulted from two different occasions that Allison came to me with things that I was just puzzling about. And now when we look back, it's kind of interesting. But we lived on a little piece of land with a creek in the back when the children were young. And one day she came up, she had seen a weasel that was turning white for winter. So the head was white and the rest of it was brown. And she was very intrigued with this. And so we were talking about the name, you know, that it, when it's white, it's called an ermine. But when it's brown, it's a weasel. And so you kind of grow into the seasons and you grow into this new name. And then at a different time, I don't even know how much time, maybe a year or so, she came home from school one day and just came very pensively and said, Mom, do you ever not know how to be, even when you're with your friends? And I thought about it, and to me it was very moving, but it was a kind of adolescent statement. And so I wrote it down somewhere. And at some point pulled them together in here. And of course, now a phrase like that means a lot more to me. To be a 10 or 11-year-old coping with a sexuality that doesn't fit anybody's pattern that you are around, what do you do with that? How do you talk of it? Who do you have to speak to? Or who knows? And I can't even really imagine what that's like, but I try to, because I think that's our obligation, is to try to imagine that. So this is called Ermine. A tall girl in large glasses perches immobile on a log near a creek. Her rounded shoulders hunch against the nameless future. Her lips move, but she makes no sound, and her shadow steals away in the twilight. Nearby, a small wary weasel stares out at her from beneath the roots of a fallen elm, its head white against winter, its body still soft brown. It watches the girl, the creek flows, light fades, neither move. When the snows come, it will have a new name. She wonders, between the brown time and the white time, does an ermine ever not know how to be, even with its friends? Will she ever know the safety of a new season, a new name? One other idiosyncrasy that we've noticed in our family photographs is that no matter how Allison is dressed, she's usually got one sock falling down, the knee sock types, and it just got to be something we chuckled about, so I had to write about it. You arrive running, all bone and sinew, and on every photo after, one sock wrinkles down. Later, word comes from Lesbos that you are here only for a visit. I had thought you mine, that I could own you in my image. But you insist and show me that wonderful mind of your own, revealing the rib-blocked secret, your becoming self coming fast before my very heart. I don't remember when I first knew of the wild gene loose in our family, but dressed in fringed leather, I stalked it all of my youth from the back of a horse and avoided men till one unlike the others came and stopped my quest. I saw it first, though, in a farm-bred aunt who left the farm by bus to teach from coast to coast and always on the move kept open invitation wherever she lived for those who didn't fit. Then a nephew, drawn a 10 to the religion his mother left to marry a Lutheran, sought a monastery education like a moth finds flame, and you came, adept at math and music and secrets. I am surprised it took me so long to recognize the gate, when at age 1 you careened down the hall of our first home, marked even then by the wild gene. My mother and I wonder aloud to each other. My father and I loud wonders to each other. Sister and I wander away from each other, and brother and I with little to wonder about, such a cushion to spring from, more like a trampoline. All the tendons and bone creating a springboard, and at any time any one of us can fly out of sight. We keep doing our own individual leapings, our pirouettes, and then springing off one or the other's most recent event, like last Easter in a brown South Dakota park. The family was walking and talking, and two took strong issue, thought it the wrong time and place, but several others of us knew it was just right for the announcement made by a grandchild to her grandmother about the grandchild's gayness. And she and that grandchild talked long on a bench holding hands, the bone and sinew keeping the tension just right between us, between them, while others of us flew at each other about timing and such, not admitting the issue lay deeper than we could go on a mere holiday. The real wonder was the tendons, the tissue, and the bone created a net that held, even as some of us flew off and up, having a long fall back. I don't know how to say this. You are not what I expected. Your father and I came together at a particular moment in our knowing, and from deep inside me, you already were made in the image of the great God who loves you even more than I do, and that's saying something. Made in my image too, of course, and your father's, those young years when you looked like him, the tomboy ones when you walked like me, and now a woman on course among careless teachings and wrong-headed ones, you make your way, all the while reaching a hand back to me. I will keep up, but I am not as young as you nor as urgent. But I am coming, dear heart, do not get out of sight. I am coming, and I will bring others. Bringing up parents. You, young parent in the city park with your proud eyes following that child on the jungle gym, think of it. She may be a baby dyke, the photos in her baby book forever revealing what you cannot yet name. Or you with the brown-eyed son who loves costumes and then lives in them, adopts another name for weeks at a time, insists on velvet, sometimes lace. Or the two of you, much decorated Navy captain and city librarian wife with the ramrod young man taking all honors in his class at West Point, yet he seldom writes home, holds his secret so tightly to his chest that if he held out his hands, he might fly straight off the planet. So straight-laced this culture, narrow, no room for a gay heart to spread its wings, soar, damage done early. Parents of gay children, throw off your embarrassment,
Send with pride that family Christmas photograph with your daughter holding her beloved's hand. New breed of pioneers, their child, much loved grandbaby cavorting between them. Two wonderful mamas taking their urgent time bringing us all up. And then I had a wonderful thing happen. I love nature, and the things that happen in nature are always so instructive. And a few years ago, we got a frost in Minnesota that sort of clipped the blooming trees. And then they didn't do very well. And in the fall, they tried to bloom. And people looked around and noticed these trees blooming in the fall. And I was noticing it. And one day I was driving home from work, and I saw these trees blooming in the fall. And I just started to write in the middle of the car seat, driving down a hill, and got home and ended up with this. It's called Coming Out. And it's how I wish coming out could be. All over town, crabapple trees have come out blooming in the wrong season, the wrong climate. And people have noticed, yet no one can account for it. So some have begun to consult the specialists. Others hold that an early frost last spring set the trees on a different course. But in any event, it is nature, true nature at her surprisingest. The way I see it, the only thing to do is sit back, enjoy, or get out of the way of their blooming in our front yards, along roadways, and in the far distance. But I would urge you to stop long enough to attend closely their beauty, the fragileness of flower, study the blooms and tight buds, the leaves coming out all around us as most other Midwestern trees turn gray. Daughter, sometimes I know your eyes follow me, and I would like to talk to you in the language of women, easy in each other's company. So often when I try, the words are wrong. My humor like a tune off key, not well received in your ear or your heart. But I promise I will wait for a day when we reach the same language, the sounds deep in our memories of another time, when in the womb strumming the same chord, we needed no words.
This is Allison.
Hi.
Mama, you once wrote a poem for me. At a time when I was young and angry, I didn't want to hear your words. Watch me run away from you. But Mama, won't you smile with me today? This different daughter is heading home. So Mama, I wrote this song for you. At a time is heading.